Radu got his PhD in 1999 at the University of Cambridge with the UK with the thesis on quantum gravity. After that, he has worked in Italy at the ISI, Institute for Scientific Interchange, in Bristol, the Hewlett-Packard Labs, and in Sydney recently, before he moved to QC last summer, or last September.
It was last summer.
Yeah. So Radu's interests are in quantum information foundations and also in the implementations of quantum information processing. Today we have a talk on the most foundational work that Radu is doing, and the title is classical set theory compatible with quantum experiments? So,
thank you, Giulio, for the nice introduction. It's great to be here. It's one of the hotbeds of quantum foundations. It's nice to see a revival of this topic after so many years of obscurity. So this is a topic I've been thinking for some time. I think the origin was when I was doing my PhD, but then I kind of shelved the project and I didn't have much time. I had to go to do some implementation. So it was a kind of pet project. I didn't have much time to devote to it. So it's something work in progress, and it's good that I think I present it here because I hope to have a nice input from the audience. So the outline of the talk, I'll try briefly to say what's the trouble with quantum mechanics and setting the scene for why we're interested in foundations. Then I'll focus on the main part of the talk, which is set theory versus Bell inequality, and can we derive some insights from the violation of Bell inequality in terms of mathematical foundations and maybe new mathematical tools. And then I'll end up with the overview and conclusions. So I think what drew me to this topic is better expressed by Bohr, who said that anyone who's not shocked by quantum mechanics has not understood it. Coming from a classical perspective, I mean, we all grew in a classical world. Quantum mechanics gives you a kind of disquieting feeling. You don't know how to interpret it. And words like mystery basically abound in the early writings of Schrödinger, Bohr, Feynman. So I think faced with this feeling, we can have basically two attitudes. The first one is kind of shut up and calculate, or what I would call the no interpretation interpretation of quantum mechanics. People who don't care about that, and basically they deny, they're kind of in denial. And this is basically Bohr's view. We don't need, physics doesn't have to say what is about nature, but what we can say about nature. The other attitude, of course, is that we need an interpretation. We need to make sense of what the reality is according to what we measure in the lab, according to quantum mechanics. So shortly, we need a story behind the data. And I favor this second interpretation. Of course, talking about interpretations, one has to go to the roots. And the roots was the clash between titans, between Einstein and Bohr. And I think there are two aspects here. From the point of view of realism, Einstein was clearly wrong. He wanted a theory which accounts for everything we have, for every measurement we have. He wanted a theory which has a counterpart, for which every experiment has a counterpart in the theory. And I don't think this realism can hold. So clearly Bohr was right, but Einstein was wrong in a very productive and a very fertile way, because he started the whole Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiments, and from that we have Bell, we have everything which followed and lead to a renewal of interest in quantum foundations. On the other hand, from the ontology point of view, Einstein was right, because actually what he wanted you wanted a kind of ontic system, what's the nature about? What can you say about nature? And Bohr was wrong because he was not interested in ontological properties of the theory. He was wrong, but in a kind of very sterile way, because he launched the whole school of shut up and calculate. And as I think Feynman put it, or Wheeler, I'm not sure.
Which I think it was his way to be right.
Yeah, it was his view. But basically, he brainwashed a whole generation of physicists into thinking that the whole problem of foundations of quantum mechanics has been solved by Copenhagen, which is not true. And my opinion is that a good theory not only has to predict, which clearly quantum mechanics does extremely well, but it also has to explain and give insight. So again, we need a story behind the data. What's in the black box? Quantum mechanics gives you a kind of oracle. It can predict your experiments. You set the dials and you know what you'll get out. But it doesn't allow you to see what's inside the black box. Personally, I'm not satisfied with this type of oracle because I want to see what's inside. I want to see how the things are working.
But in what sense would be wrong not to do that?
Sorry?
In what sense would be wrong not to do that? I mean, in what sense Copenhagen?
Well, yeah, you can have it, but I think for me it's kind of engineering point of view. I don't care about what's the fundamental type of nature. If the black box gives you the right answer, that's all I need to know. I think it's a personal choice. Mm-hmm. People are not interested in how things are work. They're just interested to get the right results. But it doesn't satisfy me as a physicist. I'm looking for something else. That's all what I'm saying. So clearly, the main problem is that quantum mechanically is highly successful, but it doesn't have an agreed interpretation. And basically, after more than a century, there is a plethora of interpretation: Copenhagen, de Broglie, Bohm de Broglie, Manewalds, Ithaca, and so on. They all predict the same thing, but they clearly don't agree with each other. And we still don't understand what's behind quantum mechanics. We just get used to it, which is a different thing. So one of the questions I start asking was, do we have the wrong tools? And what I'm trying to answer in this talk, or to make some inroads towards answering the question, is what mathematical structure are compatible with the quantum experiments, with what we see in the lab, what we measure? And related to this is a different question, which is, how do we arrive at mathematical concepts? How do we form our concepts of, let's say, geometry, of number, of group? I'm not a Platonist, so I think the answer will be provided by this talk, my answer. There are two intuitions behind the talk. The first is that any theory provides you with a framework for asking questions and finding answers. So it sets a kind of lens through which you look at the world. And the more successful the theory is, the more difficult it is to remove that lens and to look at the data and look at nature with an unbiased eye. So from this intuition, I would say, let's focus on the data, let's focus on the experiment, and somehow decouple and put a bit aside the mathematical framework of quantum mechanics. Let's look at what the data are from a slightly different point of view. The second intuition is that all the classical concepts are somehow distilled from our interaction with a predominantly classical world. So clearly, these concepts don't describe well quantum experiments because they're not designed in the first place to do it. So the second intuition would be, let's try to distill new concepts to see if we can go that path. So then I would like to reframe the problem and to look at quantum experiments through the lens of mathematical foundations to see what new type of mathematical concepts can you distill from what we do in the lab, from the data we have in the lab. One of the first who touched this subject was quantum logic invented by Birkhoff and von Neumann. they basically pointed out that there is a failure of classical logic and how we reason about propositions when we try to think and to apply it to quantum experiments. And the failure was the distributive law. They show that quantum propositions or propositions about quantum events do not obey the distributive law of Boolean logic. So we need a different type of logic. Quantum logic program has not been very successful. It has been for quite a while. And there are not many inroads, and there are not many successes of that program. So one of the questions I would like to address is, how deep is that contradiction between classical and quantum? What else fails? And the focus of the talk would be on the consequences of Bell inequality violation for mathematical foundations. So I would like to shift the focus from probability, which is the natural framework of quantum theory, towards set theory. Now, there are a couple of arguments why this can be a good idea. First, set is a primary concept. It's much more fundamental than probability, because probability is a measure. It assumes much more than set. Set is very basic. It doesn't assume much. And also, it gives you a link between mathematical foundations and quantum foundations. The second argument is that sets are conceptually much more robust. What do I mean by this? Sometimes we can define sets but not probabilities. As we know, they are non-measurable sets. So we can not define probabilities in that case. So a set is much more robust from that point of view. And a third argument is that there is no such thing as probability meter. When we go in the lab, we don't have an off-the-shelf probability meter. There's, what we measure experimentally are sets of events in certain configurations, so number of clicks in detectors. And from this primary data, we derive probabilities with assumptions like the law of large numbers and so on. So it assumes much more. As I mentioned before, I want to focus on the Bell inequality and see what can tell us about mathematical concepts. Of course, Bell inequality is formulated in terms of probabilities, so I need a different type of Bell inequality, and that's the Bell-Wigner inequality. So Wigner derived a very simple Bell inequality in terms of sets only, without assuming anything about probabilities. So we have basically the standard setup with a source in the middle, which emits a singlet. Half of the singlet goes to Bob, half of the singlet goes to Alice. And each of them measure the projection of the spin along three axes, A, B, or C in both sides. And basically, the Bell-Wigner inequality is expressed in the terms of coincidence detections between what Alice measures and Bob measures. So this means that the number of clicks in which Alice measures the spin along A direction with plus and B measures the spin on the B direction with plus is less than the number of A and plus. So Alice measures A with value plus, B measure, Bob measures C with value plus, and the same for the other one. It's very simple to derive this inequality if you assume a realistic model. So the basic assumption is that particles have realistic properties, so they carry a kind of label. So then when they are interrogated, they output that label. So real is assumes that the properties for measuring spin according to A, B, and C directions are intrinsic to the particle. So we have basically eight sets of data. On Alice's side, a particle can have A plus, B plus, C plus when it's measured. So it's that means that when this type of particle is measured, it will output plus with when the direction of the measurement is A, plus on B, and plus on C, and so on. Now, because there is the source is a singlet, we know these are perfectly correlated. So on both sides, the particle should output A minus, B minus, C minus. So this is a very simple derivation from Wigner or from Sakurai. So there are 8 such possible sets. And if you look at a single particle, it's very easy to say that to see that the number of particle with properties AX and BY, whatever X and Y are, plus or minus, is the number of particle with AX, BY, and C plus, so the projection of the spin along direction C plus, and plus the number of particles with projection of spin being minus. It's an elementary property of offsets. And basically, from this property, you can see probably that yellow cannot be seen. This one, there's a yellow box. Can you see that? Probably not much. When you add N3 and N4, which are the number of particles with property A plus, B minus, and C plus, and A plus, B minus, and C minus will give you the number of particles with A plus and B minus, then this is less or equal than N2 plus N4, which are the green ones, plus N3 plus N7, which are the blue ones. And now the crucial point is that you cannot measure directly these number of particles, because automatically when you measure a particle, you destroy it. So you have to have an extra assumption saying that when you measure correlation, so this is the N rond here, when you measure correlation between A projected with plus and B on plus, this is the same as N3 plus N4, which basically gives you plus and minus on Ali's side or minus and plus on Bob's side. So it's really a very basic and simple derivation of Bell inequality in terms of sets and particle numbers without involving probabilities at all. And of course, we know that this inequality is violated in the experiments. So what basically the question is, what is wrong with this? So the main assumption is that of realism, which says the number of particles with certain properties AX and BY can be written as the number of particles with property AX, BY, and either C plus or C minus. So what I'm trying to show, and this is the main result, is that classical set theory in the Zermelo-Frankel with or without choice implies equation one. Equation one implies Bell-Wigner inequality, as we've seen from the previous slide. And we know that experiments violate Bell-Wigner inequality. So there is a contradiction here. And the conclusion is that the Zermelo-Frankel set theory cannot describe well quantum experiments, and we need a different framework. Before I go further, I would like to do an intermezzo and talk a bit about set theory and introduce the main, very briefly, the main assumptions and the axioms. So the set theory was basically invented by Cantor, and a set is one of the most basics, one of the most basic concepts. It's just a collection of elements. It turned out that this naive approach of Cantor led to some paradoxes, and one of the famous, most famous paradoxes is Russell paradox, which can be expressed in the construction of the set of all sets who do not contain themselves. Is that set part of S or is not in S? And that led to a contradiction. So from that contradiction, basically, it came out axiomatic set theory and basically the limitation of size doctrine, which means there is no set of all sets. So mathematicians try to limit the size of sets because the set of all sets will give you some contradiction. You cannot talk about the universal set. There is no such thing as a universal set. So as we know, set theory represents the foundations of mathematics. And basically every known concept is based on set theory, starting from unordered pairs, which is the simplest concept apart from sets. A set is just a bunch of elements. You can construct ordered pairs, which basically is the set, unordered pair AB is the set unordered pair AB plus the first element A. You can construct Cartesian products as all the sets ordered pair in which the first element is in A and the second element is in B. You can construct from that relations. A relation is just a subset of a Cartesian product between two sets. Functions, which are a particular type of relations. Numbers, natural numbers, integers, rationals, and so on. You have Cartesian products, so you can construct R to power n, vector spaces, groups, manifolds. So we can see that everything it's based on set, on the concept of sets. So they're really fundamental and they're the basis of mathematics. I will present the nine axioms, which are known as Zermelo-Frankel with choice. And basically, this axiomatizes the set theory. The first one is very simple. It's the extensionality, which basically says if two sets have the same extension, they're equal. So if all the elements in A are in B and all the elements in B are in A, then A equals B. The second axiom, pairing, it's actually redundant, but usually it's included for historical reasons. Says that if you have two sets, you can construct a third set, which is basically just the pair of A and B. Union, for any collection of sets, you can construct the set which has all the elements containing all the sets of the collection, which is the normal concept of union set. Power set, it's the set of all subsets of a given set. So basically, all these axioms construct more and more sets from basic sets. Separation, that's a very interesting axiom and it will turn out to be crucial later on. It says that for any set A and any proposition or condition P of X on elements of A, you can construct a subset of A, which are those elements in A which obey, which satisfy condition P. The infinity axiom asserts that there is an infinite set with the properties that the empty set belongs to it, and for any element X, X union with the set containing X is also in the set.
Can you repeat the separation axiom, please?
Sorry, which one?
Five.
For any set A and the property P on the elements of A, I can construct the subset A sub P, which are those elements in A for which P is true. So P of X means P, the element X. To give you an example, take A, the set of all cars, and P, the property of being red. I can make the subset of red cars, for example. So it separates. It makes a subset of that set obeying the property P.
Of course, this requires the language of logic. So
yeah.
There before set.
Yes.
Set.
So there is
like
an interesting...
comes before set theory.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So basically, set theory assumes as the background logic. But there's an interesting twist to that, and I'll come later. I will come later to that. Replacement, which says that the image of any set A under a map F is also a set. The well-known axiom of choice that for any collection of sets A sub I, there exists a set which has a single element from every set in the collection. This is very controversial, and some versions of set theory do not include it. That's why it's called ZF, so Zermelo-Frankel without choice, or ZFC, Zermelo-Frankel with choice. So these are the two names for what system of axioms to use. And the last one, foundation, which says that for every non-empty set A, there is an element disjoint from the set itself. This will not play any role later on. So let's go back to Berlin equality, and let's try to see what went wrong. So we have the set of elements S with property AX and BY. This is this follows from the realist assumption that the quantum particles which you measure have those properties as intrinsic. So I can talk about the set of elements with property AX and BY. And basically, I can write them as the set of elements A having property AX, BY, and C being plus or C being minus. Now, what it assumes are basically I can derive that equation from three assumptions. The first one is the axiom of separation, which says that for any S and property P, I can write there exists such set like SP and S non-P, where S sub P is the set of elements in S with property P of X. So basically, starting from the set S, AX, and BY, I can define the sets AX, BY, and C plus for which the projection of spin on the C axis is plus, and the other set C minus, AX, BY, C minus, for which the projection of spin on C is C minus, because these are intrinsic properties. Then from the law of non-contradiction, I know that P and non-P is false, which means that these two sets are disjoint. So there's no overlap between AX, BY, and C plus, and AX, BY, and C minus. The third one is the excluded middle, which says P and non-P is 1, which gives me basically that S sub P union with S sub non-P is the whole set. So there is no alternative. Either C is up or C, the projection on the C-axis is plus, or the projection on C-axis is minus. There's no third choice. So basically, from the first three properties, the separation, non-contradiction, and excluded middle, we derive that the number of particles, so this S is the set of containing these particles, and N is basically the cardinality of that set. And what we use in deriving Bell-Wigner inequality are the numbers. So basically, from this and these three, we can derive that NAX BY is the set of, sorry, it's the number of particles with those properties. Another ingredient in deriving Bell-Wigner was the assumption that all sets have positive cardinality. Because when you derive inequality, there are a couple of ends, and basically you write the inequality by neglecting some of the ends, and obviously those ends should be positive. So all these properties are true in a classical set theory, in Cantorian set theory. But since we know that in experiments these inequalities violated, the only possible conclusion is that either Zermelo-Frankel or non-contradiction or excluded middle cannot all hold in quantum mechanics or in basically in what we measure in the lab. So the question is, what has to change? Which of the four properties have to be abandoned? If we think of non-contradiction, there are other type of logics. There are paraconsistent logics and dialetheis, which deal with contradictions. So that's one possible way of thinking. Of course, all these are unexplored because I think nobody, from what I've seen, nobody was trying to link paraconsistent logics or dialetheis to quantum theory. And it, I think it would be a fruitful road to pursuit. The second one would be negative cardinality. This looks a bit strange, but there are some hints that in quantum theory, especially in Hardy's paradox, there are negative particle numbers. So there have been experiments done in optics with weak measurements, and they confirmed that they obtained some negative particle numbers in one of the arms of the interferometer. So, of course, this is not direct proof, but there are some tantalizing clues that there might be something there which might be of use of understanding these concepts. The third one, if we assume separation holds, which might not be true, of course, there is an interesting property. These sets in which we define particle with properties ax, by, and c plus, and ax, by, and c minus, they might not exist. They might be empty, because we know that in quantum mechanics, at least, we cannot define particles with projection, with a spin projection along two non-commuting observables as valid. So basically, we can define the sets, but we cannot define, and in that case, the sets are empty. But we cannot define probabilities. So what I'm trying to say is that although the subsets don't exist or they are empty sets, this set exists because that's what we measure in the lab. We measure the coincidence between AX and BY. So again, it looks a bit like 0 plus 0 is 1, or it looks a bit like superadditivity on quantum channels. I don't know if there is any relationship or can be linked to that. Again, it's a tantalizing clue. So two sets which are empty, the union of them give you a non-empty set. In terms of channels, quantum channels, we know that there are channels which have zero capacity, but when used together, they have non-zero quantum capacity. Again, something classically which cannot be understood in terms of classical concepts. Another possibility would be that there are more than one Ur element or atoms. For example, in classical set theory, the empty set is an Ur element. We might be able to construct set theories which have different type of Ur elements. Again, these are questions, and I don't have an answer to them. Now, I come to what Julia asked before, that logic is prior and it's a kind of foundation for set theory. Is the background logic, which is assumed when you define the axioms. There is a very interesting theorem called the Iaconescu's theorem, which proves that in certain type of constructive set theories, the axiom of choice implies the excluded middle, the principle of excluded middle, that either P or non-P is true. Now, this is quite interesting because it shows that an axiom of set theory implies a principle of logic. So the interrelation between set theory and logic is not simple. It's not, there is background logic, and from that one, you assume background logic and you derive set theory. There is a deep interrelationship, and it might not be possible to consider, in certain cases, set theory without logic. And they might be both, they might need, both might need to change. So to conclude, I think there are strong indications that Zermelo Fraenkel set theory it's incompatible with violation of Berlin equalities, because assuming Zermelo Fraenkel, you can derive the Bell-Wigner inequality, which we know it's violated experimentally. So ZFC plus logic cannot describe, is not a proper framework for describing certain quantum experiments.
This with the background assumption of realism.
Yes, of course.
Yes.
But if you don't assume realism, then you automatically assume that they cannot be described in terms of set theory. Because realism...
So when you say Zermelo-Fraenkel, you mean applied to the values of...
Exactly. That basically quantum particles have definite values, have properties which are intrinsic and can be described in set theory. If you don't assume realism, somehow you automatically assume that you cannot describe them in terms of those properties.
But of course, you could apply set theory to outcomes of experiments.
Yes.
Without contradiction.
Certain extent, yes. But I think this shows that there is something which we don't really understand and about quantum particles, and we might need a different framework, mathematical framework for that. Or they point to a different mathematical framework.
If you take the de Broglie-Bohm model, then it has the realism property. I mean, it gives you definite values for things. And yet, it also is capable of violating Bell's inequality. I don't think it violates any of these axioms of set theory that you put forward.
I don't know.
So I think there must be more than, you must be making more assumptions. It seems like you're sneaking in some kind of non-locality, or some kind of locality or non-contextuality type assumptions also.
I think they're both assumed in more radicals. Because we assume like local properties
that are predefined. So it assumes the type of properties which are local and intrinsic to particles. So I think that assumes locality.
Okay.
I don't know how Berlin inequality is violated in Bohm's theory. I'm not aware of that.
But it seems to me that the sort of they're violated. I mean, you get Bohm in the pilot wave model, you get agreement with quantum theory. But the theory is perfectly well formulated mathematically. There's no unusual mathematics in it, I don't think. And so it seems to be a good point of comparison. If you're thinking about changing the structure of set theory, you don't have to. In that case, it's quite possible to get agreement with quantum theory.
Yeah,
so,
I have to think about that. There is a historical parallel, and that's Euclidean geometry. So until a few hundred years ago, Euclidean geometry was the geometry. By some philosophers, was considered even as a preliminary law of thought. You cannot think outside Euclidean geometry. And of course, you can do experiments, say measuring the angles of a triangle, and see if what you measure in nature conforms with that. And if you do that measurement close to a black hole, of course, the angles of a triangle will be less than pi. So I think what points out here that in the same way as we do have non-Euclidean geometries, we generalize classical geometry and basically they evolve from negating a single axiom, which is the axiom of parallels, and you extend the geometries to non-Euclidean by dropping one axiom. You can do the same in set theory by dropping, for example, separation axiom. You can extend set theory to non-Cantorian set theories, and maybe that, presumably that non-Cantorian set theory could be a better mathematical framework to explain what we measure in the lab. Going back to what Lucien said, I think you can also explain the geometry close to a black hole in Euclidean terms, if you define, and it's perfectly valid to define other types of paths, you define forces, and you can understand the geometry close to a black hole in purely Euclidean terms. But it was a change of perspective to understand that the concept of space-time is based on non-Euclidean geometries. So it's the same type of parallel. You can explain the same phenomenon in two different ways. So for example, the Cantorian set theory points towards this type of inequality, which looks a bit like triangle inequality, but it's just an apparent similarity. And I think if we go in the lab and we measure the outcome of the experiments, and we see that this inequality is violated, I think this points towards a non-Cantorian framework. And we have, I would like to think in terms of what would be a more appropriate mathematical framework to describe those experiments. In the same way, for example, in which if you measure geometry close to a black hole and you're pointed towards non-Euclidean geometries, you can do the same with set theories. So basically, the conclusion I would like to draw is that quantum experiments point towards new concepts in mathematical foundations. And this is the start of a more ambitious research program to open a two-way avenue between mathematical foundations and quantum foundations, and to see how we understand nature in terms of what type of mathematical concepts. I think one of the interesting question is the role of experiments in defining new mathematical concepts. There is a famous essay by Hilary Putnam who asks, is logic empirical? And he pointed out to the fact that our logical concepts are derived from our interaction with the outside world. And of course, in a classical world, we construct a type of logic. But if we go to quantum experiments, that points towards a completely different type of logic. It will be interesting to see what quantum properties like contextuality and so on can point towards catalyzing new concepts like non-classical logics or non-Cantorian sets and so on. So there are a couple of open problems, like which ones of the four possibilities pointed out before, like axiom of separation, the positive cardinality, excluded middle of non-contradiction fails. How contextuality can fit in here, what it can have to say about new mathematical objects we can define. And last but not least, of course, it will be interesting to derive predictions and Gedanken experiments to see what we can measure in the lab. Thank you.
Looking at the list of four things you suggest to look at, to get rid of the axiom of separation, unless you replace it by something very similar, is essentially to not be able to do any mathematics. If you cannot, that is the only axiom that allows propositional functions to enter into construction mathematics. So if you can't simply do away with that, then you can't do anything. So you have to replace it with something somewhat similar. It was the super axiom separation called the axiom comprehension that was relied on by Cantor to get that Russell used, I should say, to get the set of things that don't contain themselves. So the axiom comprehension simply said that for any propositional function, you have all the things that satisfy it, was replaced by the axiom separation, which says in any already existing set,
exactly,
you have all the things that satisfy a proposition. I don't know how you would further restrict that. That would fit in with the problems you mentioned. The other one that you mentioned in set theory was cardinality. If I'm if you have negative cardinality, that means a new concept of cardinality. I'm not certain if it changes set theory. It's just, it sounds, I don't know what you mean by it, but it sounds like you're describing an additional quality to define on sets. That sounds like it might have some traction, some things you can do with. That is, it's a new thing that you can play with, and maybe it'll get somewhere. And the other two, excluded middle and non-contradiction, are actually in logic, not in set theory. So that's getting fuzzy logic or something.
Well, first, the excluded middle, I think it's violated in quantum logic. So we know at least one point in which it doesn't hold. But where it goes from that, I don't know. The separation axiom is also known as restricted comprehension, because the first axiom of comprehension was too large, and Russell indeed, if you can define for any proposition P the set of elements obeying for which P of X is true, then you get contradiction. So that's why you restricted it to a prior set. So it's a subset of an already existing set. Of course, this is, as you pointed out, it's fundamental for constructing new sets. You have a set, and then you define a subset of that with the property P of X, for example. I think the problem in quantum mechanics is that we can't really describe those type of objects. So if we know that an electron or a photon has a definite property, like polarization plus or polarization horizontal polarized, if you ask, can you define from those sets of electrons or photons which you can prepare in the lab, can you define the set of electrons which have polarization along x-axis plus and x-axis minus? In quantum mechanics, it doesn't make sense, because polarization along z-axis and polarization along x-axis do not commute, so you just cannot define that set. And I think that's the root of the problem, because in set theory, you can define, starting with a set of elements, I can define, having a proposition P or a property P, I can define those elements with property P. But in quantum mechanics, you cannot define that. If I know that I have a set of electrons polarized along z-axis vertical, I cannot define what is the property of those elements. Sorry, I cannot define the polarization of those electrons along x-axis.
But those are not logical propositions. Those are physical propositions. So it seems that perhaps the point of issue should be the what things that naively we think might be good physical propositions are in reality not good physical propositions.
But then it goes back to the question of, can you describe, that was the question, can you describe those quantum particles in terms of set theory? If you assume that you can describe them in terms of set theory, then you have to use all the axioms of set theory, and you have to use...
It's physical theory.
Well, we should allow for other questions.
I've come to follow up on what Lucien said, which, I mean, you've snuck in some assumption of non-contextuality in describing this Bell-Sakurai experiment. And I think whereas usually people assume that, well, the culprit is locality, or non-contextuality is the assumption that people usually assume the suspect, when you talk about violation of an inequality like that. So, I mean, is it the case? Why did you pick this Sakurai-Bell experiment? And if you look at the standard Bell EBR setup, do you also have an assumption of locality plus some set theory assumption? We could easily decide it's not the axioms of set theory that are the problem, if you can show that they only arise in the context of this particular setup. I mean, we know that locality plus realism in the standard EBR-Bell setup leads to a contradiction with experiment, right?
I agree. So in the background, I didn't want to mention that there is locality assumed, because if you think of first particle sending a message to the second particle, then it can give the right answer. So I was assuming locality because there are many experiments done with specially separated events. For example, I think Gizin group did the DPR experiment with moving detectors, and he concluded that if there is such a message passing between A and B, it should be to a speed more than 10 to the 6 the speed of light.
Okay, so what you're saying is you don't want to abandon the assumption of non-contextuality. So you want to abandon the assumptions of set theory instead? Is that essentially what you're saying?
No, I don't think so. I'm not following.
Yeah, you want to keep locality and abandon some other set theory axioms.
No, I think the main assumption here was realism. Can you describe those particles as having real property, intrinsic properties? Mm-hmm. And if you'd be able to do that, then you use set theory in terms of defining subsets of that, and I think that's violated. So it's something which is not...
Technically speaking, what you call realism means non-contextuality plus locality.
I think you're certainly assuming realism, but you're also assuming, in the standard way, some kind of locality or non-contextuality assumption. That the number of counts at one device doesn't depend on the choice of settings at the other.
Yes.
It seems to arise exactly in this setup. So I don't know why you picked this particular... I mean, actually, it's a bit obscure. I didn't even know about this Bell-Sakurai contradiction.
Bell-Wigner.
Bell-Wigner. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, in Sakurai, it's derived in that way.
It's in Sakurai's book, yes.
Yeah. The reason for that is that I didn't want to go into probability. I wanted to see, can we look at the quantum data without assuming probabilities? Can we put a bit aside the conceptual foundation of quantum mechanics? So as I said in the beginning, one of the intuitions was that the more successful a theory is, the more difficult it is for us to abandon the conceptual framework of that theory and to think outside the box. So I wanted to go strictly at something very basic, because probability assumes a lot. Probability as a mathematical concept is not as basic as set theory, is not robust, because, for example, the standard explanation of why you violate Bell inequality is that there is no such thing as a joint probability P, A, B, and C, A, B, and C, which gives you, basically, by marginals, gives you a P probability of A and B.
I mean, but ultimately, your experiment was not the number of counts associated with each measurement setting, which is exactly what happens in a Bell experiment. You don't even have to talk about probabilities.
Yeah.
You can talk about relative frequencies if you wanted to.
Exactly. That's why I was focusing on number of particles, and basically, this is how they derived the inequality, not in terms of probabilities of or expectation values, but just number of one of the most basic things which you measure in the lab. You measure counts. This is your primary data. From that, you derive probabilities, you derive with extra assumptions. So I was trying to go to the raw data, in a sense.
So these sets that you're talking about, they're just ordinary sets with finite numbers of members. They're not in any way unusual. They're not the kind of sets where you'd expect something to go wrong mathematically. So it seems to me that in order to be convincing, you'd have to sort of to take your analogy with geometry, you'd have to do what Einstein did and actually show how you could explicitly exploit the breakdown of these axioms to have a constructive theory which you could use to calculate what we'd expect to see in experiments. And I just don't see how you're going to do that. It just seems these sets are very ordinary sets. They're just, you know, like you do an experiment, you have 20,000 sort of events or something like this. They're not in any way unusual. So I can't imagine how you're going to exploit this breakdown to actually do something significant. Do you have any idea how you would do that, like explicitly, rather than just pointing to the contradiction, see if you can show how you would explicitly?
Not yet. So this is something which I started recently, and I'm thinking
about like
those.
A hint or some.
One of the things would be to devise a Gennaken experiment, which you could implement in the lab and see exactly what would be the difference between this approach and the normal approach.
Right.
But coming back to what you said about these are normal sets, when you think in terms of sets, I mean, the concept of set was derived by Cantor in analogy with classical objects, which can be either here or there. I mean, they have definite properties. You can decide if the object has a certain color or it doesn't have that certain color. You can't do the same with quantum objects.
But that comes back to Stephen's at his point that really it's about the physical assumptions behind it. That once you've got those physical assumptions in place, i.e., the assumption of local realism, then mathematically these are straightforward things. So, are you really raising a physical question, or are you raising a mathematical question?
How do you describe objects? How do you construct your mathematical theory? So, my answer to that question is that your mathematical objects are constructed or are distilled from your interaction with classical objects. So, all the constructs like set, group, space, locality. Are based on our interaction with the classical world. Now we're facing with a quantum world which has completely different properties from the classical world. We're talking about non-locality. How do you describe non-locality in terms of a continuous space? We don't have that mathematical concept.
I mean, but there are non-local theories, like the de Broglie-Bohm model is non-local, so we can do that.
So just following up on that, I just want to clarify what the goal is, right? So in a certain sense, is the objective to have something that, you know, you called realism this assumption that particles have these definite properties and associated with the idea that you have these sets of properties that are sort of attached to each particle, and that's sort of a realistic model. So is the objective, on the other hand, to have something like a set of sets of quantum properties which obey certain rules, and that would be but those rules would be different from the ZF axioms plus this other stuff, and that would then be some sort of a realistic interpretation of quantum mechanics but with just a different set of rules. Is that the objective ultimately?
In my view, the objective is to see what new mathematical concepts we can construct and then apply those concepts to describe the physical world, because that's what we do in classical physics. We extract some concepts, we extract some regularities, we define some mathematical concepts, and then we apply those concepts to describe back in our theories. So basically we use mathematical tools to describe what we observe. But I think the breakdown is that before the advent of quantum mechanics, we did not have any experience with this strange world in which particles can be in both places at the same time. All we know from classical world is that either an object is here and has some real properties, or it's there, and so it can be described in certain types of mathematical properties, like set. And I think all these concepts of set, spaces, and so on are distilled from that interaction. But when we came to face a completely different world, somehow we should distill or extract new mathematical concepts. And then with those mathematical concepts, try to describe what we see. That's the idea behind this program.
I guess I was just trying to clarify what would count as sort of a successful account of quantum theory in this framework. And you know, if a successful account of a realistic classical theory are, you know, sets of properties that combine in certain ways according to the classical rules of set theory and logic, and that's what led to the Spell inequality. On the quantum side, then, what would count as a successful formulation of quantum theory? Would it again be some sort of family of sets of properties that you could somehow associate with quantum systems that obey some new rules of set theory? Would that count as a successful account of quantum theory? Mm-hmm. I think I'm saying more or less the same thing you're saying. I'm just trying to clarify exactly what would count as a positive outcome.
I think you put it right. So I'm trying to see what new type of sets could explain those properties. Think of extending the notion of set in the same way we extended the notion of number. So for another, let's say, historical parallel was the Pythagorean school. So for them, a number should have been, it was a rational number. So they had a concept that the universe is ordered and chaos doesn't have any role. It cannot play any role. Therefore, any number, any true number should be commensurable. And they had this strong notion of a number should be a rational number. But we know that irrational number in the universe is just diagonal of a square. And for them, that was a big conceptual blow. They could not understand in their framework why that should arise. But for us, it's very simple. We just extend the concept of number. There are certain type of numbers, and there are certain, like rational numbers, and there are other type of numbers which are non-rational. That's it.
Sorry, very last question.
If you agree with his description of what a good outcome would be, I might suggest there's almost something that's pretty close. Isham has this formulation of quantum theory in terms of Topos theory, where you replace like classical Boolean logic with an intuitionistic multivalued one, and you have a very realist type setup that you can explicitly associate propositions to quantum systems, and they always have a truth value. It's not necessarily zero or one, it's something much weirder, but there's kind of a realist interpretation similar to that, so it's something you might want to look at.
Yeah, that's one of the things which I didn't go into. I know about Isham program and Deering, but I didn't go into that, and I have to see more what is the outcome of that. So I'm not familiar with that.
Let's thank Radu again.